Dive into the world of dance at the Victorian College of the Arts. Their program offers a unique blend of artistry, performance, and a choreographic practice within an inclusive environment. As an undergraduate student, you explore contemporary dance, physical theatre, ballet, urban dance, and more in a collaborative studio lab setting. At honors level, specialize in performance skills, choreographic practice, or dance research. Plus, benefit from the proximity of local choreographers and companies including Philip Adams, Stephanie Lay Company, Lucy Guerin, Chunky Move, and Dance House. Through professional placements, their students have the opportunity to develop pathways for their future careers through these relationships and networks. Consider a variety of bachelor, master's, and even doctorate programs available according to your needs. Join them and unleash your artistic potential at the Victorian College of the Arts. Learn more through the link in the descriptions below.
Thinking about what factors are informing not just the writer's emotional response to a work, but also their evaluation of that response, that needs to be thought about and balanced really carefully. That said, if we're talking about the post-truth phenomenon, I do hope it goes without saying that, you know, while the dance itself may be subjective, fact-based storytelling about dance, the facts themselves are, of course, not subjective.
Hello and welcome to The Background Dancer. I'm your host, Jason Yup. Thank you for joining me with our community of passionate dance contributors from around the world and across different fields. In this podcast, I offer educational conversations and insightful tips to help you better understand all things offstage about this curious art form. Dance can be quite an enigma, and dancers can be both the most storied personalities and completely forgotten artists in society today. As a dancer and multidisciplinary artist myself, I've constantly experimented with the boundaries of dance and how it can be represented through one particular medium, or many for that matter. Before the advent of TikTok, dance relied very much upon print media and other more conventional approaches such as newspapers and books to disseminate. Bar the very few that could produce tape recordings, it was simply down to the written word. Then we had the YouTube revolution born from the LA choreography scene in the 2010s, immense spawning of dance podcasts throughout the pandemic, and of course TV with the seminal So You Think You Can Dance and Step Up series. So this begs the question, what is the best medium to grow dance? While there isn't and never will be one definitive answer, one company comes admirably close to putting this debate to bed. Dance Media Publications, as the company is so aptly called, is a multi-varied media platform that covers dance like none other. Branching out from its core are leading print issues such as Dance Magazine, Dance Spirit, Point, and Dance Teacher. When I first began developing an interest in podcasting, the obvious keywords to type into a search bar would be things like dance, performing arts, arts, dance industry, etc., etc. Unsurprisingly, the podcast under perhaps currently the biggest dance media network popped up, Dance Edit Podcast. Long story short, Dance Media Publications, or Dance Media in short, delivers engaging content to the most dancers, dance professionals, and dance lovers you'll ever see, or listen in this case. When the time finally came, I duly reached out to Margaret Fuhrer, formerly the editor-in-chief and producer of the Dance Edit podcast. A journalism graduate from the New York University, her writing has been published on esteemed platforms such as the New York Times, the Huffington Post, and the Brooklyn Rail, just to name a few. Margaret has also worked on other dance media outlets such as the Dance Spirit, Point, and the Dance Magazine, the latter of which she now devotes her work to. Best of all, she is the author of the book American Dance, The Complete Illustrated History, published in 2014. More personally though, she has been a recurring voice in between my ears throughout these past couple of years ever since I started avidly following the show's extensive reporting. In this episode, we explore what it takes to pursue a career in journalism as an arts writer and perhaps ambition to work for one of the best media companies in the arts. While it's not easy to dance, the dance of art journalism is surely something more fascinating. So, sit back and enjoy as we experience from the beginning, all dance, all the time. Hello there, Margaret, and a huge welcome to the Background Dancer podcast. It's been a long while, and I've been really trying to get you on this show for, I think, as long as I've started my podcasting journey, which was about a year ago. And it was because I stumbled across the Dance Edit podcast, of course, you know, searching for dance podcasts. I've become a very, really avid listener. So I've actually been having your voice in my ear for quite some time now. So it's really nice to finally be able to sit down with you today and really crack open your head with regards to dance, media, and the company Dance Media. So once again, welcome to the Background Dancer, Margaret.
Thank you, Jason. It's so great to be here. And thanks for listening to the Dance Edit podcast too.
Absolutely. It is one of my favorite shows because not only does it talk about dance, it is incredible material, the resource. It just spins my head all the time as to how you manage to find all these things, all these news, all these sources, right? Because everyday news coverage, they have their networks, they have their agents about, their journalists and all that. Not sure how dance is actually able to do that. And you're not only covering things in the USA, you're also covering things all over the world. So it's incredible material, incredible resource. I have so much to ask you, but I'm just going to start things off with a very simple question, actually, just to give the listeners a good base to start off. And that is, can you give us a little bit of a journey as to what exactly does an arts writer and editor does?
So, I mean, as an arts writer and an editor, I think it's similar to other jobs in the editorial field. It's a great deal of, as you've said, news hunting, just trying to constantly be on top of what is actually happening within this world, this dance world in particular. It's simply a specific window on that world. And that doesn't mean that we never cover things from outside the dance world. In fact, frequently dance is a lens through which we view larger social problems. For example, mental health issues, which were at the forefront of many people's mind during the pandemic. The dance world experienced those in a very specific way, but in a way that could also speak to people from outside of the dance world. So a lot of, in terms of like the day-to-day work is probably similar to an editor in working in any subject, just in terms of news gathering, working with writers, shepherding stories from ideation to completion, but with that specific angle on it.
A little bonus question. This will be the first of maybe two bonus questions for this session. I'm just really curious, how do you get all that information? Where do you get your news? Because it's incredibly extensive, and I just don't understand how dance has that kind of ability to cover the whole world. So would you be willing to share some of your secrets?
Oh, I mean, I don't think it's that much of a secret. In terms of how I actually gather stories for the Dance Edit newsletter, for example, which is supposed to be a pretty comprehensive overview of all the news happening in the dance world, some of it is reader-submitted tips on social media, which we really appreciate, especially for international news, because that is a little bit outside of our normal scope. We're US-based. But the vast majority of it is simply trolling the internet all the time. Curating a Twitter feed that is a great group of sort of news aggregators in their own right. So either dance journalists or other publications that are really good at staying on top of minute-to-minute news. And then also just simply, I mean, I have like 15 different Google alerts that I just troll all day. It's nothing groundbreaking. It's just time, and after a while, you know where to look and which sources are most trustworthy.
Hey, Jason here with a special message for you to help and continue serving our beloved performing arts community. So here's what you can do. Share this with one person you believe who this episode can benefit and attach a personal note explaining why. This way, you are not only helping me grow this show, but also adding value to those you truly care about. Massive appreciation, as it means the world to me. And let's get right back to the show.
Okay, wow. That really provides the foundation to any aspiring writer and editor, I believe. And actually, quite interestingly, I've also started my own kind of quasi mini journalism, side hustle kind of thing. And it's really nice that we've been able to collaborate, because through this podcast, I've been able to increase the scope of my writing in preparation for every episode. So it's really nice to be able to bring that also into my practice. And this leads us to our first big lesson.
The news business has had many inherent problems. A declining appetite for news among the young, a breakdown between news and entertainment values, public mistrust over our power and objectivity, etc., etc. And when the president of the Columbia University finally issued his fairly innocuous statement of his educational goals for journalists, the most noted public response was brutal. He believed that most journalists should be credentialed by universities, and journalism, he says, should be seen and should see itself as a profession. The backlash relates to Lee Bollinger's vision of snob journalism. Journalism by an elite for an elite. The resounding fear at the time was that ultra-professionalism would grant a select few institutions the power to limit and standardize the field, which in turn would put it out of reach of the common citizen. But this anti-professional attitude in journalism is nothing new. It is just evidently stronger today than it has been in generations. And what about the arts? Yes. Snobbery is still all over arts journalism, which makes things both limiting and troublesome. Highbrow or lowbrow distinctions are at best arbitrary, and at worst, classist or racist or both. Journalism must remain a craft, something marinated in the streets and forged by doing it rather than merely thinking about it. Only this will make it responsive to the public and ensure its economic vitality. Dance Media saw an opportunity to provide a form of writing that harmonizes news and entertainment, elements inherent to the art form itself, and benefited as a result. Looking for ballet tips? Try Point. Interested in entrepreneurship? Check out Dance Business Weekly. And if becoming a teacher is what moves you, then Dance Teacher is right there for the taking. Ultimately, like what you like, but don't assign value based on your own preferences. Don't be a snob, be more curious.
Let's talk about art journalism to begin with, right? Without art journalism, the world would be even more oblivious to the arts. Arts is not just something that provides value, but, you know, inherently as well, and paradoxically, arts is not really something people always want to cover on headline news and CNN and all this kind of big stuff. However, the one thing that you talk about regarding snobbery is really interesting, and I just want to get your thoughts on this. Like, how do you think ignorance has been able to make its way into the arts industry and, in fact, remain such a worrying problem after all?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because I doubt any arts journalists would ever think of themselves as, or describe themselves as, ignorant. Most of them are deeply knowledgeable and passionate about specific areas of the dance world or the arts world elsewhere. I mean, they have to be, really, because nobody does this job for any reason other than passion. I mean, this field is certainly not lucrative, and at the moment is highly unstable too. I think this issue is directly connected to snobbery, because part of the problem lies in the types of dance that journalists decide to prioritize, implicitly or explicitly, and the value judgments that they make in those decisions. For example, if you believe that ballet is the center of the dance universe, and many dance writers do, you might be a leading expert in that particular part of the dance world, but totally ignorant of many of its other corners. And especially its non-Western corners, we tend to see that a lot. So you have to have enough curiosity about your own blind spots to start eliminating those blind spots. And if you lack that curiosity, that's essentially what snobbery is believing that what you know and what you are most passionate about is the center of the dance universe. I think another sort of related problem is how arts journalists conceive of their audiences. Because for a long time, a lot of, and I'm talking mostly about dance writing because that's what I know most about, but particularly criticism, and also beyond criticism, but particularly criticism, it was speaking to a very narrow group of people. Often people who already thought and felt or were sort of expected to think and feel the same way that the critic did. And if we're only talking to that small group of people, we're doing pretty much the opposite of what good journalism should do, which is continually expand the circle of people who are interested in and invested in dance.
Now, I want to jump on that point as well and actually look into something that you yourself are. So you're an arts writer, you're an editor, and regarding snobbery in journalism, is there snobbery within the hierarchy of journalism as well with regards to the two different types of job? Because they're very different types of job. What are your experiences on that?
Do you mean in terms of the different types of arts covered in arts journalism? Because yes.
Okay, let's go with that because that's a great point. And then actually what I wanted to say is there also a snobbery within the hierarchy of journalism? For example, you said an arts writer, right? Like a writer, for an editor, basically like there are a lot of levels to it. Someone who does chief editing, someone who does just editing. And I think there are definitely like distinctions within that row. So yeah, maybe help us clarify that as well.
Yeah, I mean, it depends what type of publication you're working for. So for, you know, like Dance Spirit, the print magazine that I worked on for a long time, we had an editor-in-chief, we had a managing editor, we had some senior editor, we had a senior editor, we had a couple of associate editors, and we had an assistant editor. I wouldn't say there was snobbery built into that hierarchy. It was more based on experience. And some of those jobs were a little bit different in terms of what the responsibilities were. Particularly the managing editor was responsible for more sort of facilitating the business side of things, making sure that everything procedurally was running smoothly. So that was a little bit different. I don't know, editors versus writers. I don't know if there's, I'm sure some people would say there is a certain type of snobbery that writers distrust editors and editors are annoyed by writers. I think that there's always some of that because everybody on all sides has strong opinions because everybody on all sides is usually very passionate about what they're doing. But I also think they involve, each of those jobs involves distinct skills. And without people with each of those skill sets, highly specialized skill sets, you don't get a good piece of journalism. So it requires all of those players. Did that answer your question?
Absolutely, absolutely. Actually, it's a very kind of ambiguous field to look into as well, right? Because when you talk about like the snobbery, you can look at it from the hierarchical level. You can look at it from, like you said, you know, the genre, the discipline level. And you already kind of mentioned it. There is a lot of that going on with regards to the different types of arts. So that is definitely out of the way. Like we all know that we're part of the arts. So we can definitely say this is an unspoken rule to kind of deal with. And talking about skills, talking about specialization, actually, this is a perfect way to segue into lesson number two.
Being a journalist isn't a cookie cutter type job. The topics, communities, hours, and stories evolve daily. It keeps us on our toes and coming back for more. So, what are the prevailing factors that truly motivate a journalist to write and keep writing the best stories? One fundamental motivation is the curiosity to get to the bottom of a confusing or complicated issue and find patterns that help explain it to readers. Making sense out of chaos, especially when you can do it first, is something many journalists find very rewarding. Another reason could be telling stories in a compelling way. How does one tell an important story so that it will be read to the very end? How to write the kind that can move readers to laugh or to cry? As a subscriber of the Dance Edit newsletter, I receive a petite daily rundown of the world's most prominent news in dance. Basically, think of your evening 8 p.m. news you or your parents watch, but purely dance-related. When asked how she did it, Margaret admitted that it merely required time and effort, through Googling and scouring for news every single day without fail. Well, thank God for the internet, and thank God for Margaret. Maybe it is more about the how rather than the what. As journalists, it all starts with often rhetorical questions. Margaret herself has evolved significantly in this regard since starting out as an editor. Her main criterion used to be, is this a story she'd want to read? But centering herself that way is inherently exclusive and contradictory. Now, the questions she asks are, how would her audience learn or otherwise benefit from this story? Is this a story that hasn't been told or told enough or told from the most meaningful perspective? The factors will always exist, but it still takes one to constantly interrogate those factors that drive one to write or assign a particular story.
So my fascination really points to the power of storytelling, because I think storytelling is really key to almost every form of good content producing and good content consumption, right? Mm-hmm. Which is why it's so important to, for example, to frame the right narrative in the news that we wish to write. And it's all about the narrative. Like, the narrative really carries someone from point A to point B. So let's hone in and zone in on you. What are some of the core factors that drive you to tell the best possible stories?
So when I'm choosing which stories either to pitch as a writer or which stories to feature as an editor or assign as an editor, there are some sort of more basic things to consider, like newsworthiness is always a consideration, especially for the stories we're telling via the Dance Edit newsletter and podcast and the Dance Edit Extra, which is our interview series. Those are news products specifically. So we want to make sure that we are addressing the stories and the ideas that our audiences are currently engaged in. And then on the other side of that, we want to make sure that we're also addressing stories that are newsworthy but have not been sufficiently talked about, that have been undercovered. What information can we give readers or listeners that will improve their dance literacy? I think when framing a story, for me, the two most important things are, first of all, the voice telling the story. So does this writer, does this interview guest have lived experience or expertise in the subject matter? Are they being tokenized based on their identity? Can they tell the entirety of the story at hand? Do they have like a 360 degree view on it? And that's something you can probably relate to this too. That's something that's often challenging as a podcast host specifically, because we're expected to be like expert guides during interviews with a huge range of people, you know, often people whose experiences are far different than our own, which is a good thing. But it also means that we have to think really carefully about not letting our own voices shape the storytelling too much, but allowing the guest to be the main storyteller. And then the second thing, which is related, is making sure that the story provides adequate context for readers or listeners. So what is the true center of the story that we're telling? Are we approaching a set of facts from a skewed or a narrow perspective? Are we interrogating or appropriately contextualizing ideas or quotes that might be problematic? We want to make sure that we give readers or listeners all the tools that they need to absorb a story in an informed way.
Lovely. Love that. All right, I'm going to throw a curveball at you with regards to news and storytelling, right? So I'm going to draw some sort of analogy here. When there's demand, that creates value. And likewise, I kind of see it as when there is news, sorry, when there's a story that generates news, mm-hmm. or vice versa. If there's news, you can kind of, you know, whip up a story about it. But the question then is all news story worthy? Is all news story? Most stories are can be news, mm-hmm. but it's all news story.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting question, especially given the way that we sort of absorb, like take in our news today, where the landscape is flattened. So if you're reading things on a Twitter feed, no matter what it is, it feels like news, no matter what the level of story, no matter what the level of the depth of the reporting. So I don't think all news is sort of longer story worthy. I do think there are different types of stories that deserve different types of coverage, or that are appropriate for different types of coverage. I don't want to say deserve. I think that's actually where having the different dance media products is especially helpful, because the Dance Edit, for example, it's a news digest. So if you have something about, say a ballet company has announced their season, or there've been a bunch of dancer promotions, or, you know, even like sort of fun, but not necessarily super serious news, like they just installed a giant dance floor and disco ball at Lincoln Center. That's fun. That's great. That deserves a 2-line summary with a link out in a news digest. And that's, if people want to go deeper, they can. If they don't want to, that is okay as well. But when it comes to dance stories that are more complex, that require more reporting, that require more thought, that require more investigation, we also have outlets with the resources and with the tools to do those stories justice. And are those stories then sometimes featured in the Dance Edit newsletter? Sure. But hopefully positioned in a way that encourages readers to go deeper, that tells them, that conveys to them the idea that there is more to the story beyond the 2-sentence summary you're seeing.
All right. It's really interesting that you brought up the Twitter part, because we're definitely going there later on. But let's highlight the idea of storytelling once again. And there's something about storytelling that I know you would probably attest to, and that is it brings a lot of more personal qualities to it, right? There's a lot more historical dimension, let's say, to a storytelling, let's say, piece compared to, like you said, just hard, cold news. So let's talk about tech a little bit. Let's talk about how that kind of integrates with dance. And let's move into lesson number 3.
Words have power. Their meaning crystallizes perceptions that shape our beliefs, drive our behavior, and ultimately create our world. Their power arises from our emotional responses when we read, speak, or hear them. Just say the word fire while barbecuing, or in the workplace, or in a crowded theater, and you'll get 3 completely different but powerful emotional and energetic reactions. Yes, even the words of others can easily affect our personal vibration. Spend a few minutes with a chronic complainer who constantly spouts negativity, and you'll feel your personal energy bottom out. Simply put, words are extremely potent tools, even for the unpleasant. That's why the Dance Edit podcast shines light and bright among all the dance media subsidiaries. Just like this show, podcasts have elevated the spoken word to a whole other level of consciousness in the lives of content consumers. And while this medium does not, and perhaps will not, remove the immovable influence of written words, the landscape has changed completely when mixing voice into the equation. Suddenly, a word is no longer just another variable, but one accompanied by the human emotion and imagination. Regardless of which medium you prefer, we all just need tools and more options to express ourselves better as communicators, which dancers are by default. Speaking of tools, I'm often asked, is Twitter or social media in general a reliable source of information on historical revolutions? That's a lot like asking, is television trustworthy? Are newspapers any good? At the end of the day, it's just a tool, and it depends on how you use it. This is true for everybody, but especially journalists. The internet has indeed flattened the media landscape, which means that a tweet can be as influential as a fact-checked, deeply reported 5,000-word story. So, whatever writing you're putting out into the world, make sure it represents your best self. Words are powerful. Wield them thoughtfully.
We are talking a lot about words and how there are some potent tools. There are literally things that we use to reach out into the world, to put ideas and thoughts out there. right? But I want to take a few steps back and really look at the medium of the word. So right now we can see all the most significant communicative methods and even forms of media one way or another represented and even commercialized with various like tech enterprises, right? And you can start with, for example, YouTube dominating the video space. You have music, which I know YouTube has a strong hold on, but it's very much represented now by Spotify. I think it goes hand in hand with Spotify and the whole streaming revolution there. You have voice, which is now being, of course, like taken over by Clubhouse and all the other stuff that came after that. But Clubhouse was really much the pioneer of like social media for the voice. Like, that's a pretty interesting idea. And of course, we are finishing at words with Twitter. Right. So Twitter really kind of took advantage of the power of words. I'll add another one, though. And this is actually kind of interesting. Dance has a place in it, too. And it's called TikTok. Mm-hmm. So I think contrary to a lot of dancers that I've worked with, like, I'm very fascinated with the potential of TikTok. And I'm actually very grateful that it exists because it really has put dance on the map much more than we could have ever wished for. So let's start with this question. What is your perception of dance as not just an emergent media stronghold that TikTok has turned us into in a way, but potentially also like a staple of media itself towards the future? Is there a world where dance is a medium to communicate at a mainstream level like TikTok has been able to do for us?
I think it's already happening. I think video-based digital platforms like TikTok, like YouTube, which I would argue even before TikTok came around, was having a huge impact on YouTube, to like Instagram to some extent. Instagram is now trying to do a pivot into video. Dance is such a natural fit for all of those platforms because it's so visually appealing. And the rise of those social platforms in particular has, I think, already in many ways been game-changing for the dance industry, because at least in theory, it makes dance more democratic. Like a lot of the gatekeeping that used to happen in dance, you know, you weren't really seen as a dancer unless somebody in power had chosen and hired you, right? That was the old way. That's much less of a factor now when any talented dancer with a social media account can amass a large following. And that's led to a different type of dance celebrity emerging. I think TikTok is fascinating because it's a different type of dance that's often prioritized. It's not even about showcasing the like quote unquote best dancer or about, you know, like fetishizing a certain kind of body, which is what a lot of the Instagram dancing has become about. TikTok is more about what performers what regular people performing have the sort of charisma and quirkiness that are that app's stock and trade. Like bringing joy is sort of the common denominator there. Anyway, that was a bit of a tangent. But so with all of this technology, we're just seeing more dance everywhere all the time. And I think commercial dancers in particular, who previously were often totally unknown because they were, you know, dancing behind a musical artist or somewhere else in the background all the time. Now, thanks to social media, a lot of them are names in their own right. So on paper, which I guess is a funny thing to say about digital technology, but on paper, that's great news. Like more visibility for dance, more visibility for dancers. Fantastic. I do wonder, first of all, about how that shift is shaping dance culture. Like how does the like economy change the way we think about what a quote unquote successful dance looks like? Are we moving to a place where like, you know, YouTube catnip flashiness is taking precedent over a certain slowness that I think also has great value in dance. And also, it's definitely not as if these social platforms are purely democratic. I mean, as we saw with movements like the Black TikTok strike, some voices are not being heard and are not being elevated in those contexts. I'm going to get on my soapbox again because I have one other point to make about this. And that is now that so many of these dance artists have huge scopes of influence, how do we properly credit, first of all, and compensate them. Because, for example, when a TikTok dance challenge ends up pushing a particular song like all the way up the Billboard charts, because people are streaming that song over and over again to learn the dance, you know, that makes the music company millions of dollars. So how should the creator of that challenge be recognized? How should they be compensated? Those are really important questions to consider as the way we consume and interact with dance changes thanks to these digital technologies. End of soapbox rant.
Well, it's quite funny that you brought it up, because I think a couple of days ago I did read a piece that pointed out that TikTok has integrated new features that allow creators to to be credited much
crediting
properly,
features
right? Like better. Yeah, that's a breakthrough. I think it's a breakthrough. Let's bring it back a little bit and talk about words now, because really this lesson is about the power of words, right? And despite all these digital platforms, like you said, it's literally a digital revolution for dance itself, which of course you've already pointed out, started back in the YouTube dance kind of age, where all these big YouTubers became like the stars of dance, right? We've seen it mostly in the choreography, like the LA, you know, scene kind of thing. But I think you and I both know, when you step into a studio, for example, me as a Malaysian Asian coming to a place like Europe to work, Europe has tons of different languages, different cultures. You come into a studio, no matter how much body language, how much movement you can sync within an artist, you really only have words to truly relay those messages. And oftentimes the words that you use will be like the quintessential element of establishing a very strong connection with a fellow artist. So the words are at the very end of the day still what really drives a particular connection, right? Now, we all know the biggest, hottest, latest news is Twitter, of course, being purchased by Elon Musk. And I wonder, you know, Dance Edit does have Twitter. I've just started my Twitter account. So having all these things kind of, all these roads lead to Twitter. How do you think dance can capitalize on Twitter's potential future with Elon and just its newfound presence as the truth beholder? Hey everyone, if you're like me and prioritize online privacy and security, you're going to love NordVPN. Not only does NordVPN safeguard your internet connection and protect your personal data from hackers and snoopers, but it also offers an amazing advantage: seamless access to geo-blocked content on platforms like Netflix. With NordVPN, you can browse the web with peace of mind and enjoy your favorite shows and movies from anywhere in the world. Plus, their user-friendly interface makes it easy for anyone to stay protected online. And here's the best part. NordVPN offers a 30-day money-back guarantee, so you can try it risk-free. Trust me, I've been using this for 2 years now, and it has totally changed my life. What's more, you can get the basic plan for as low as $5 a month. By signing up through the referral link below, you not only support your online peace of mind, but also help me and the continuity of this show. So, sign up for NordVPN today and let's serve smarter and safer together.
Oh gosh, I really hope Twitter isn't seen as the truth repository of the world, because I don't think that's its greatest use. I have to confess, I'm not totally up to date on all of the Elon Musk news. I know there's been a lot of back and forth there. I think Twitter is a great place for dancers, for dance artists, for dance enthusiasts to find community, to discover people who are thinking about the same things they are, who are reading the same stories they are, who have the same objections to the same stories that they're reading, who are equally upset about what they're reading, which is often the way it goes on Twitter. More generally speaking, outside of Twitter, if we're talking about the power of words in a dance context, I think you're totally right. People often underestimate how important the words we use to describe dance are. And finding the right words is incredibly difficult. That's something you discover really quickly as a dance journalist. Yeah. A big part of your job is trying to figure out how to do that translation, that act of translation, which is almost like a magic trick. It's so hard. I think one good thing that came out of the pandemic is when, in studio settings in particular, when we were unable to rely on bodily communication. And I've heard this from some dance artists that I've talked to. We all became a little bit better at that form of verbal communication, at describing dance in words or describing the ideas that motivated a dance in words, which I think is really valuable. And I hope that continues. I hope that doesn't go away. I'm very far away from Twitter now. I apologize. Twitter itself, I do think it's very useful as a news source. I do think it's also complicated as a news source because of, as we talked about before, the flattening that happens on Twitter, where every tweet in your feed seems to have equal value, even though they're coming from totally different places and reflect totally different knowledge bases. And a tweet featuring a link to a deeply reported story that a writer has worked on for 3 months shows up right next to something somebody dashed off in 30 seconds. And so then it's up to the reader to distinguish between the two. I think we have to be careful about that. I think that obviously is not unique to dance journalism or arts journalism. I think that's a general issue. And I have to say that I personally am not a huge Twitter user because it makes me intensely anxious, the fact that the words that I put out in that tweet can be assigned the same value as the words that I put into a long story that I've worked on with three different editors and has been fact-checked. You know, I get so nervous about that. It makes me deeply anxious. So for that reason, I'm personally less of a tweeter, but that doesn't mean I haven't found great value in the community that I've been able to identify and build on Twitter. So yeah, I mean, TLDR, it's really complicated. I don't know.
Great way to end there. Well, just to put the icing on the cake, like, yes, I can definitely feel it from so far away. Like, I feel the pain, I feel the frustration, I feel this angst, right, being on Twitter as a writer, as a journalist, having seen your work placed next to something that could, in all honesty, be called trash if they were really fact-checked, if they were really deeply reported on. And it's the same thing, you know, when you go on Instagram and you do something great, you post great content and you get sort of submerged underneath the algorithmic ocean, let's say. That's also really why I haven't found a way to use Twitter as a dancer, as a dance artist. I'm just like not sure what to do with it, like what to say on it. But now that you've mentioned that it's a good place to convene for community, I think I have a head start. So I really want to thank you for that, Margaret. I'm just going to end with a bonus question that I provide for all my guests. And this is something that fascinates me actually more than anything else. To be honest, that's why I'm always very excited to ask this question at the end of every session. Margaret, personally for you, what do you think makes a dancer?
What makes a dancer? Oh, there are like 5,000 different ways to answer that question, which I guess is why you ask it of everybody. What makes a dancer? Anybody who dances is a dancer. That's the most basic answer. What makes a great dancer? Or what makes a compelling dancer is a different type of question. Again, a very subjective question. We're now back to talking about feelings instead of facts. But my subjective view on it, what makes a great dancer, is anybody who has completely invested themselves in their art. And that's really just what makes a great artist. But it's true of dance too. Anybody whose level of commitment is absolute in a way that you can feel when they're dancing. And that doesn't mean that, as we've said before, just because they're absolutely committed, they should be expected to make sacrifices because of that commitment. But anything that you, if you can feel that complete immersion, that complete, that their entire nature is subsumed in this act of movement, that makes them a great dancer. I'm not really answering your question.
Well, no, thank you so much. That was a great way to tie it all up. And once again, that's the reason why I asked this question, because you actually have answered it in 10,000 different ways yourself. So I'm going to take it back home and kind of brew
that. I've danced around it.
Stew that. Yeah, you danced around the dance-related question. Well, I have to say, thank you so much, Margaret, for your energy, for your generosity, for your newsworthy qualities, and for bringing all of that to this platform. For sure, there are a lot of aspiring writers and editors like you who are listening, and I think this has given them a great base to sort of build their careers on. And it's actually wonderful because I think the background dancer and dance edit share this in common, and that it's, that is really trying to provide all of the best materials and source of inspiration for up-and-coming young next-generation artists to really propel towards the future, to build a dance career, to build a performing arts career, which is really, really tough to do. So with all of that, I would love to just once again thank you so much for your time and for being here on The Background Dancer.
Oh, thank you so much, Jason, and thank you for the work that you're doing, because that's exactly right. Information plus inspiration. That's what we're going for.
Margaret Fuhrer has been my guest today, and you have been listening to episode 3 of a brand new season titled Dance of Art Journalism. Be sure to check out the show notes for links and references mentioned throughout our conversation, or you can visit our website at www.backgrounddancer.com for all related information. Margaret's work ethic and passion for dance has shined a light on our often obscured and underrepresented community. For more, consider purchasing the full version ad-free for only $3, or access the entire year's catalogue of 20 episodes for only $55 by clicking Support the Show. While a single purchase grants you access to episode transcripts and weekly online hangouts exclusive to the Background Dancer community, the annual premium package will come with additional benefits such as bonus unreleased episodes and monthly career consultancy sessions with me as I provide you with insights on navigating the world of dance through my decade-long experiences within various facets of the industry. Lastly, don't forget to leave a 5-star review and subscribe to our YouTube channel of the same name. In our next entry, we'll hear about the importance of podcasting as media in the arts. Stay tuned for my conversation with dancer, choreographer, mindset coach, and host of the dance podcast, Lauren Ritchie. Have a great week, and I'll see you in the next one. If you're listening to this, you are most definitely a dance enthusiast, maybe even one for dance science. Well, why not join the International Association for Dance Medicine and Science, or IADEMS for short, and become part of a global community dedicated to supporting dancers and performers worldwide. With active members from over 50 countries, including experts in dance, medicine, and science, IADEMS provides a diverse network of support and resources. As a member, you'll gain access to exclusive benefits such as discounts to year-round events, their vast collection of e-learning opportunities, and a subscription to the Journal of Dance Medicine and Science, amongst other incredible and unique offers. Join the mission for better outcomes and apply for an IADEMS membership today. Click the link in the descriptions below for more info.